You're listening to the City Gospel Movement's podcast, where we celebrate and accelerate collaborative gospel work in cities around the world.
We believe God is already at work in your city. We're here to help you ask, what is God doing where I live, and how can I join in?
If you love your city, love the church, and believe God can do amazing things in your city, you're in the right place.
Let's get started.
The church has some amazing answers to some societal problems that are going to become worse and worse. We see it. It's getting nasty. And so we can choose to be a part of the nastiness, or we can choose to be a part of the solution. I personally am encouraged.
Gospel Movement's podcast family. That is a mouthful, but I just want to thank you for listening and remind you to subscribe. That is the best way that you will be in touch with our latest resources, and we have some really exciting content planned for the end of the year and also for 2020, and podcasts don't magically expand. It really is a group effort with awesome listeners and the team who creates a podcast. And so we would love for you to subscribe and really let us know what you're thinking of the podcast, which is why I'm excited for you all to hear from Kaden House. Kaden, you lead our communications team and want to let our listeners know of a couple important details.
Yeah, well, team is a generous word considering I'm one person, but yeah, we love having this conversation off the podcast and continuing it, and we want to hear from you, our listeners. And so I'm really behind the scenes a lot of times, but I have those conversations through social media and through our emails, and we want to continue having them. So please, please DM us. You can find us on Instagram. Our name is City Gospel Movements, no spaces. Just DM us, please. We want to have this conversation, and we want to continue hearing from you and what you want to hear even on this podcast.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the City Gospel Movement podcast, where we help celebrate and accelerate gospel movements in cities around the world. Today, we have an incredible guest with us. You've heard that data is king. Well, on today's podcast, we're going to be talking with the queen of data, Brooke Hempel. Brooke is the senior VP of research at Barna, where she manages the firm's research studies, which is a huge job. We are going to explore current trends, what the research is saying about Gen Z and millennials, and how you can participate in activating the next generation to be causal. So, Brooke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for that gracious introduction.
Well, Brooke, I think it's always so great to start a podcast with just getting to know who we're interviewing and kind of why they do this work. So would you kind of walk us down that road? When I looked at your bio and, you know, you could be doing so many things and yet you're choosing this work. So fill us a little bit in on just kind of your why.
Yeah, so I think that evolves the more I do my research. I started in corporate environments, consulting to really Fortune 100 companies on marketing strategy and market research in financial services and pharmaceuticals and healthcare. And what was fun about that was even back in the dark ages when I was doing that, we had great data to play with.
It wasn't that dark.
It wasn't that long ago. Exactly. I'm not that young. But we had great data, which now we take for granted, but then it was really unique. And so I had the absolute blessing of learning some great skill sets early on. And I loved my work. I love finding a story out of data. And it helps you see things clearly, right? And so I had this God-directed running in with Barna, where I met David Kinnaman. Actually, when I was volunteering for a ministry, a church planting ministry that we're a part of, and went, oh, wait a second. There's people in the ministry space who need to know about data, who need to know about research, and who need to understand things. I hadn't really thought of that before. And I just hadn't had much, hadn't given much consideration to being in sort of ministry roles, but I could quickly and clearly see how God had given me these opportunities to hone my skills in the corporate sector, really, that then I could use for the church. And I was so excited to be able to do that. And so I think every day that we study a new topic, I begin to see how the insights that we're learning and the understanding that we're gaining about the world, which is, you know, constantly changing, right? It's evolving, can equip people to minister more effectively. And that's just really my passion. I want people to be able to minister more effectively.
That's awesome. I love that your worlds collided in that way. I think so often that is how God just kind of intervenes. And I've heard that story kind of repeated with people doing one thing and then they collide into this kind of aha moment of, wow, I could use this for the kingdom, right?
Yeah, it's great.
So, you know, one of the things that I, as I was just kind of thinking about Barna Group and all the things that you guys do, and it really struck me this idea of, you know, just, well, we compartmentalize things into generations. You know, you've got the boomers and the Gen Xers and the millennials and now the Gen Zers. Just for the sake of context for our conversation today, where did this kind of even all begin to kind of categorize these generations?
Yeah, it's a really good question to ask because I think a lot of people use it in a judgmental way, and that's not the intention of generations. The whole science of generations developed, you know, about 100 years ago based on shared events that a society was experiencing and knowing that those shared events shaped their worldview. So, for example, if you look at baby boomers, you know, we know that their own experiences going through the civil rights era and with Vietnam, with even Watergate, that those things have shaped the way that they interact with and see the world, right? And so, you know, every generation has these social dynamics, these geopolitical dynamics, and just world events that impact them. And it is often very country specific as well. So whatever, you know, definition you'd give to that society, that really does affect the way that we see things. So for example, if you look at millennials and even to some degree Gen Z, but especially millennials, and those are people who are about 20 to 35 right now, right? They've grown up with technology like we've never seen it, although they didn't have it from day one. They've grown up with kind of a political correctness, very respectful culture that actually is a worldview. It's different than other views, you know, being very respectful of others around you. They've grown up with believing in educational opportunity and pursuing it with great vigor. They've grown up being affected by financial crises. So they had maybe parents or other loved ones who really suffered as a result of the last recession, and they felt that. So those things shape the way that they see the world and the choices they make and how they kind of process everything else that they experience in life. And so that generational science comes from, it is actually a science, a social science that helps us to understand how our world forms us.
Yeah, I do think that kind of definition is really helpful in this context for what we're going to kind of dive into. And I think a big portion of what we're going to talk about is kind of this millennial, which we hear so much about, and this Gen Zer group. I don't know if it's Gen Z, but I'm calling them Gen Zers.
Yeah. There's actually even not an official name for them yet. So you can call them kind of whatever. Yeah. Gen Z.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's a placeholder. So Gen X never got a name. We were that short that we never got a name. That's what started it. So Gen Z is like the placeholder until we come up with a clever name for them.
Yeah. Well, I'm at the very beginning of the Gen Xers. So Gen Xers, I didn't know that wasn't the official name. Well, sadly, I think it might stick, but
yeah.
So just so for some greater context, what are the date ranges for millennials and Gen Zers? Just so that will help us kind of moving forward.
Yes. So the current Gen Z generation, they begin in 1999 and they could go down to as low as 2015, right? So they're approximately age 20 right now on the upper end. Mm-hmm. And then we don't know where we're going to draw the cutoff at the bottom. So that's the one question that we have. And then millennials will go from 1998 into the mid 80s. There's, you know, some people draw the line at a year or two different, but they're basically the mid 80s. So these are your 20 through 35 year olds.
Yeah. So a Gen Z will be at the top end, just kind of getting into their second year of college, most likely.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So let's dive in. You ready? This is going to be fun.
Yes.
So let's just start. Let's pull the Band-Aid off. Let us know kind of what are some of the key trends that you see. Let's start with millennials. What are some of the key trends that you guys have uncovered with that millennial generation?
Mm-hmm. So millennials have been sheltered. The term helicopter parents came up with this generation. They have very high expectations for their life, and they've been given those expectations. Sometimes that produces great opportunity. Sometimes it produces anxiety. They've grown up in an era of fake news and social media. And those two sometimes go together. Sometimes they're separate. Mm-hmm. But they've learned how to navigate that. They've learned how to trust sources in different ways. They've also grown up in an era where everyone's worldview is respected, I should say. So this whole concept of you do you, whatever you believe goes, that's a way of showing respect, is to affirm people in whatever they believe without applying a critical eye. And there's some health in that, but there's also some downside to that. And then they've grown up, especially recently, in an era of massive political change. We've swung from, you know, one president to the next over the last 16 years or so across some very different spectrums. And politically, they have been increasingly diametrically opposed. And so that's really shaped them and how they interact with world forces or political forces, I would say. The last thing is, I would say one of the things that we obviously track a lot is they have grown up in a shift in the church. Many of them have some familiarity with the church. Not everyone grew up in the church in their generation, but maybe they at least kind of know about the church. But as you go lower and lower in age amongst that cohort, the distance from the church grows. And their value, therefore, of the church diminishes. So that is combined with all those other worldviews I mentioned, the fact that they have a respect for people with other worldviews and religions, and the fact that they've grown up in a kind of an achievement culture, an educational and career achievement culture. So those things kind of all connect to their perspectives on church. But regardless, they are less churched than the generations before them.
Yeah. So let's stay on millennials and just talk a little bit about then knowing all of those kind of attributes, if you will, of millennials and how they've been shaped and formed. How does that then affect, you talked just a little bit about it, but I'd love to expand on that. How does that affect kind of their view of the church, of faith? And then how would you suggest people interacting with millennials in a way that kind of meets them where they're at, if you will? Like, we have to create new context for these different generations, or maybe you would agree or disagree with that, but let's start with just kind of how does that subcontext for the millennials really shape their view of the church and faith that the generation before had a very different ideology?
Yeah. So one interesting dynamic about millennials is largely due to their achievement culture. They have delayed marriage and children significantly, such that in the course of one generation, that's been delayed by about 10 years on average. That is significant. Usually in kind of societal data averages, you don't see that kind of movement.
Yeah,
that
quickly. That's a huge jump.
It's a huge jump. So what that means is, interestingly, they all also talk about the value of family. That's not as prevalent in Gen Z, but for millennials, they really value family. And that sometimes comes from that protected environment they grew up in. So they kind of have delayed this thing that they love, but also they seek it, right? They seek that sort of close relationship, that intimacy that you would have in a family. So they seek it in their friendships. They seek it in social spaces, but increasingly that's hard to do because of the kind of digital nature of our society and the fast-paced nature of our society. So they kind of want this thing that seems unattainable. The reason I'm bringing that up in the context of church is this. You know, church is a place for community. So you'd think that'd be a natural fit. But it still doesn't totally fit with their concept of what they need. So they don't think of church as the place where they're going to be known. They're going to be understood and appreciated. And also that they're going to have an opportunity to contribute, right? Because that's actually really important to them. So what happens is they kind of want some of what the church offers, but they don't want all of what the church offers. And they find those things elsewhere. And then that becomes a cycle where they find it elsewhere, that gets affirmed, they continue to seek it in other places, and they continue to walk further and further away from church. Mm-hmm. So decades ago, there used to be this theory that there was this natural progression in people's lives where, you know, they might grow up being exposed to the church, and then maybe when they went to college, they kind of dropped off. They, you know, did their prodigal son thing, they walked away. But then when they thought about having, you know, getting married, having a family, especially having a family, that they would come back to the church and they'd find their home there. And that was true of previous generations. Millennials are not doing that because for a longer period of time, and in many cases that's 15 years, they're finding their community and their comfort and their identity elsewhere. So it's a huge leap to come back to the church after 15 years. And they haven't felt welcome in the church in those 15 years because they're not married with kids. And the church is about family, right? But they don't feel a part of that. So that's one of these dynamics, in addition to the other concepts I mentioned about wanting to affirm other people's worldview. So they're a little more open to be talked out of their beliefs that they may have grown up with. So those are some of the reasons why there's this bigger gap for millennials and the church. Now, that's not to say that they can't find a church home that suits them. But the church, as it was known to previous generations, doesn't fit what they're seeking in their heart.
Yeah, you know, one of the stats that is, you know, it's just hard to read, but that you guys have uncovered is 64% of young people in the U.S. who grew up in the church won't continue in the church as an adult.
Yeah.
And I would say this is a challenging piece of your work, right?
It is. Especially because that number is growing. And so it gets more and more frustrating.
You're like, I'm just uncovering this. I don't, you know, it's almost like, oh, put it back. I don't want to know all this is going on. But I think the reality is we have to know this is going on, right? And that's exactly what you guys are doing.
We do have to know. That's so, so important.
And so how, just kind of while we stay on this topic of millennials, and, you know, I think it's so helpful to just understand who they are. And I do think that you're correct when you were saying sometimes we use these terminologies as judgments, like, oh, that's a millennial. And I just wonder if we should be kind of turning that upside down a little bit to really understand, like, hey, this isn't necessarily their fault. Like, these are the ways that they have been shaped and exposed. And so then I guess my next question is, what would your encouragement be to the church, knowing what we've just shared? How would the church be encouraged to create space for these millennials to feel like it's a compelling place to be?
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack in there. There's a lot of things that I want to be cautious and maybe caveat and say, you know, I do unfortunately get to bring the bad news a lot of times.
Yes.
And there is a lot of good that the church doesn't get credit for. So I don't want this to be church bashing. But also, if we do see these stats and we put them down because we don't want to deal with the reality, it's only going to get worse. So just like we take our medicine in life, we take our medicine in church.
Well, and I will just say too, like, you and I have both been in the corporate space. And so I think you, this will resonate with you as well, but it's no different than an organization or a product that rests on its laurels, right? And says, we're going to make this product, we're going to make it the same way. And we're not going to even bother looking at, you know, where the trends are going, because we know we've got something that's successful. And sometimes that works, but most often that doesn't work. And so I think that is why it is so helpful to gently kind of share the data. And there's an empathy piece here that I think sometimes we miss, of just having empathy for this generation that is experiencing the church in a different way. It's just that they're moving faster than the church because of its organizational structures and mechanisms is just slower to turn. So how do we help that process to meet somewhere in the middle, I guess?
So, yeah, I do think it's really important to both look at challenges to the church with a critical eye to say, what could we do to do better? And then also to look at what can we do to help millennials grow, right? So we all have something to grow and learn in all the time. We're all human. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit of both. So one of the number one things that we hear, both in our data and in feedback from young adults, is there is no place for me and no voice for me because I'm single. That is a very lonely place to be, mm-hmm. a very marginalized place to be. And for good reasons, the church celebrates families. That is a beautiful thing, and God gives them as a blessing. And they need support and help to remain whole. So that's good. But when that causes a millennial to struggle to feel connected or to feel marginalized, to feel unimportant, to feel like they don't have a role and a place in the church community, that's a problem. And that's very commonly the case. And so you see what I'll call tribalism, meaning these groups of friends that get together and become family to each other because they lack that opportunity elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's a really hard thing to cross those life stage boundaries, but it is so, so important to this group. Because they're coming from that place of not feeling as valued and not feeling as much a part of the community, it's almost like we have to overstep to welcome people in and to reaffirm how much we value their voice and their insight and the gifts that God has given them. Because it's easy for them to see and interpret the church as a place that doesn't want to hear them. And so it requires more invitation than one might suggest would be needed in most cases. And I think that's important. The other super critical element of engaging with this generation is just to recognize that the world they're living in and the world that we all increasingly are living in is different than it was 15, 20 years ago. It is really different, honestly, mm-hmm. Looking at data. Recognizing that that's true and desiring to learn from them. Well, what is this world, right? Because they're going to be the best navigators of this culture. They're actually, it's ironic, but they're the ones who are going to give us the best insights on how to reach the world today. And yet we're not reaching them. So how can we engage them to help us understand and help us to see? One of the things that they see and experience is a real struggle with emotional and psychological health. And I'm almost cautioned against using the word psychological because it means lots of things to lots of people. So if we just call it emotional health, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very real struggles.
Isolation, anxiety, loneliness.
Yes, exactly. And then things that come out of that, destructive behaviors that come out of that. And so if we don't really recognize that and really meet people there, they're going to stay there. Mm-hmm. Those are hard places to come out of. So I do look at the hard things of the church, seeing 64% of young people walking away. But I also look at what the church is supposed to be and say, oh my gosh, we have the answer. And I'm jumping a little bit to Gen Z because all of these.
Yeah, let's go there.
Okay.
let's go right into Gen Z and maybe just kind of, just like you did with millennials, share a little bit of their, I think this will just be, I'm so fascinated just to kind of even see the nuances between those two generations. So give us some, give us some highlights for the Gen Z group.
Yeah. So I'm going to circle back to this whole emotional health thing. So just keep that, you know,
hold the finger on the page.
Yeah, exactly. So they've had all the same trends, just even more exacerbated, right? They not only adopted technology, but they grew up with technology.
The first generation to fully grow up with the smartphone, right?
Yes. So we don't know what that means, but we actually suspect it means your brain's wired differently. Mm-hmm. Literally that your brain is wired differently. We won't know until their brains are fully developed, but we're beginning to see that. So that's huge, huge. The way that we process and take in information, the way that we make decisions, that all could be really different for Gen Z because of the way that they interact with technology. That's huge.
Yeah. As a parent of some Gen Zers, I'm trying to just breathe.
Exactly. Yes. I know. I had to tell someone one time, I begin to develop really high blood pressure when I start this talk, but don't worry. We get to the hope at the end. So hang in there.
Yes.
They also grew up in an increasingly PC culture where you can't say certain things. They literally gave it a name. They call it trigger warnings. You can't just talk about things that might bring up a bad experience because that might be damaging. So again, some good things, but also can be taken to the extreme. Mm-hmm. They grew up also with a lot of political turmoil. They grew up also with less exposure to the church. In fact, in this particular generation, increasingly, they've not been exposed at all to the church. Increasingly, they feel confident naming the term atheist. That's fine. It jumped tremendously in this generation, the percentage of them who are willing to say, I'm an atheist. Hmm. So you've got 12% instead of 3%, right?
Or again, 6%. A huge jump.
Huge jump. So that's true. And that also has to do, that's wrapped up with science. Science has become a powerful worldview. I don't believe that it has its right interpretation in many people's minds of what science really is, but it's considered a worldview, honestly, as opposed to a way to discover and explore the realities of what God created. So they see the Bible as in conflict with science. They don't see that one informs the other. Mm-hmm. And that's partly how they've been educated and partly how the world has shaped them. So all those things are true. And then you layer on top of this a new dynamic. So those previous trends were all kind of a little bit existing with millennials. They're really exacerbated with Gen Z or just more extreme. And then the new dynamic that's very, very deeply affected this generation is gender. The question around what gender is has been completely opened up. Anything goes right now. When we did our Gen Z study, we did a first round of research and we realized that there was something there. And the public debate was moving so fast that we actually had to do a second follow-up study to explore a little further because it was moving so fast, what was politically acceptable, what was socially acceptable, and what people were willing to believe. So we did this follow-up study, and even in that time span, we saw changes such that we got nervous about fielding our survey in certain states because in certain states, if you didn't recognize all 52 recognize gender terms as legitimate, wow, then you could be fined. So we kind of got nervous, like, oh my gosh, we can't even ask these questions because we have to address people by any of these 52 gender terms. That's a finding in and of itself. That's shaping people.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So we saw that this generation, more than any before it, and certainly more than I would have expected in the matter of a few years, is willing to question their own gender identity, mm-hmm, such that a third of them says, I might not be the thing that my parents told me I was when I grew up.
Did you say a third?
A third. A third.
Wow.
They're open to exploring that.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what's happening there is empathy. And so we see it actually more strongly in girls than we do in boys, but it exists in all of them. But it's like, if I'm going to affirm that whatever you're experiencing in questioning your own gender identity is actually real, if I'm going to affirm you, then I have to actually believe that it could be true.
I see. So it's a little bit of a taking on somebody else's as potentially your own.
Exactly. Yes. But I have to legitimately be willing to question my own gender if I'm going to say that your experience is authentic, right?
Yeah, so that's really interesting.
So there's a really interesting worldview dynamic going on there too. In addition to the whole gender question of like, what is truth? Is truth real? Is there an absolute truth or is truth relative? So we track that question forever, and increasingly truth is relative and it's defined by what you feel in your heart and what society tells you, and it can change. So that's, they're just living right into that, right? That's what they've been told from day one and they're living right into it. So immediately you then start to see the split in Gen Z. Whereas before you could maybe fake it and be a Christian, you can't fake it anymore. Suddenly your worldview is going to get called into question. You're going to have to wrestle really hard with what you believe.
Yeah. Wow. So where is this group then going? Let's turn the corner into faith and church. And then how does the church become compelling to this generation?
Yeah. So two really interesting dynamics, I think, happening. This is where my blood pressure starts to drop again and I calm down because I think hope here. One is we're producing more solid and resilient disciples. And I use that phrase. We've kind of done a lot of research around that recently. David's book, Faith for Exiles, he kind of lays out what a resilient disciple is. And it's a beautiful picture of someone who has wrestled with and come to a sense of confidence in what they believe, but also has been shaped by the community of Christians around them in a good way, such that they have mentors, they have people to ask questions of, they feel that there's a sense of purpose in their life, they feel empowered to pursue that purpose, they feel connected to God in every aspect of their life, they don't compartmentalize it. These are like super believers. I love them. It's so exciting.
What's the percentage, or, you know, a number, like, are we talking about 1%? Are we talking about 10%?
It's 1 in 10.
Okay.
It's 1 in 10. It could go up to 2 in 10. It just depends on how we define it. So 1 to 2, you know, basically 10 to 20%, have this resilient faith, this really strong faith. So what that means is they are solid in their convictions because they've had to wrestle with them and come out into a place of believing, and that they know that they have to live counterculturally, but they also probably know how to do that in a way that's sensitive to others because they do live in an environment that's very different than their worldview. So they have a beautiful reconciliatory approach to the world, which is really, I just am continually encouraged by those strong believers that I meet of this generation. They're small, but I feel like we can learn from them and we can replicate that because we're seeing what shaped them. And so interestingly, one of the good forces that shaped them has actually been adversity. So whereas we bubble wrapped our millennials, and we do still bubble wrap our Gen Z, I personally, as a parent, am like, wow, what am I doing to expose my kids to tough things? Because this will, God tells us that all through his scripture. But those, you know, challenges that we face, those trials, they shape us, they bring out the good in us, they purify us, and they prepare us for what we're going to face. So how can I expose my kids to things that will challenge them, maybe knock them off their rocker a little bit, but not so far that they can't get back up, right? Give them a chance to fail, give them a chance to question, and give them a chance to stand on their own and not be, seatbelted in by their parents.
Yeah, I love the term resilient disciple. Like, I wish they all could wear t-shirts and we would know who they are.
Yes. Well, okay, so let me give you
There's one.
Yeah. Let me give you a little bit of context on that. So in the church, so I'm gonna use the actual numbers from this particular study, which was 18 to 29 year olds who grew up as Christians. So people who fit that description. So actually currently are millennials, but we see that our Gen Zers moving into that. So you have 52% who've full on left the church. You have 38% who are still in the church, but they're not exhibiting those resilient disciple characteristics. And it's really only 10% of those 18 to 29 year olds who grew up as Christians who actually would qualify as a resilient disciple, according to these different characteristics of beliefs and relationship and how they see themselves in the world. So those sorts of characteristics. So there's actually plenty of people in the church who are not resilient disciples. And it's tricky to find them. But when you see the fruit of their lives and when you see how they stand up counterculturally, you begin to realize, okay, that's what's going on. They've been shaped in a good way to be resilient in the face of a culture that would suggest they need to go in other directions.
Yeah, they're almost standing up twice, right? They're standing up against the world culture, but they're also in many ways, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of standing up to a bit of the church culture too. And taking their ideology and the way that they've been formed to not totally own their faith, but also to take all of that into the church context. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. And you actually said a phrase that I want to call out, because historically Christians have been known for, historically in the last few generations in our country, Christians are known for what they're against. Mm-hmm. They stand up against things. But the church today needs people to stand up for things. And this generation loves to stand up for things. They stand up for what they perceive as injustices against people groups and individuals. They stand up for God in their workplaces. They stand up for peace in their relationships. They stand for a lot of things, and that actually is really important to them in their faith. You know, we've seen this in some of our young adult research, and it's not just the U.S., it's around the world. their faith needs to be coupled with action in a positive way. What am I for? What am I going to pursue? It's a moving forward, not putting up a wall or a hand. And that posture is actually, again, we can learn so much from them. That posture is really inviting to the world, right? Because right now what Christians are known for is what they're against, not what they're for. And so they navigate those spaces very well, and they're learning to grow more confident in doing that.
So what do you say to the person who might be listening and just be like getting kind of overwhelmed, right? and specifically, yeah, if they are working in ministry, whether it's a church or a nonprofit or a parachurch organization, what would you say to that person who just goes, I don't even know where to start?
Right. So the first and the most important step is to start with a posture of saying, I want to learn from them. I recognize that their world is different. They actually could be my guide to that world. Help me learn from them. Don't just accommodate them or even patronize them. No, no, no. Learn from them. They will help us to understand and navigate the culture. So give them opportunities.
It requires a lot of listening, right?
Yes, for sure. And that's, I mean, I speak as a professional listener, so obviously I'm biased, but I listen and learn. That's what I do for my job. And I think it's so important to being able to engage in conversations with others. So we have to first listen and learn before we're ready to even talk. So someone said to me, and I almost don't want to say this because I don't remember where I got this, but someone said, you know, Jesus, he didn't open his mouth for the first 30 years. He didn't speak up publicly in ministry. He listened and learned, even though he knew it all. He listened. Mm-hmm. And he watched and he learned. So we need to even more so take that posture. So we start there. We start with listening. We start with knowing and just being aware that our church actually does have a culture that's not a blank slate. It's got a fully formed culture, and we need to assess that culture and how well it accommodates or welcomes or invites people who might not be from that culture. And that can be age. That can be racial differences, that can be gender differences. We just need to be really aware of our culture and just kind of have a critical eye about, okay, so what are we doing that we might not be aware that we're doing that communicates something about who's welcome here? So that's an important first step, is just to do some self-examination in the church. But I think the other side is to then feel relieved that in this time, and so I'm going to speak to Gen Z especially, but in our culture as a whole, the church has some amazing answers to some societal problems that are going to become worse and worse. We see it. It's getting nasty. And so we can choose to be a part of the nastiness, or we can choose to be a part of the solution. Mm-hmm. I personally am encouraged, because what I've seen, while we've seen church engagement drop, both in the number of people who attend church and in the frequency with which they engage with church. While that's true, you get this whole concept of wheat and chaff. That's not to judge the people, it's to judge the reality of why they're coming. So we've stopped wasting our time. We've put our time where it matters, right? And so what you have seen is people who might've been cultural Christians in the past, and they came to church because it was their social club, or they came to church because they felt a sense of guilt they had to do it, they've left. Because they don't need to be there. There's no societal
pressure. They don't feel guilty anymore.
No, there's no pressure to be there. And therefore, a lot of that baggage has gone with them. So when we do research with people who are in their 40s and 50s, they carry a lot of baggage about the church. When we do research with people in their 20s and the teens, it's a blank slate. They don't have those perceptions. They, a lot of times, haven't even been exposed to it. And they're open. They're curious. So I, as a parent, had someone, another parent, ask me, hey, you know, I grew up in the church, but I've never taken my kids to church. I'm not a Christian. But I kind of feel like, I mean, they're getting close to their teens. I'd really like them to know what Christmas is about. Would you mind if I brought them to church with you so that they could just see what Christmas is actually about? Gosh, that blew my mind that we even had that conversation. So A, their kids had never been exposed to the story of Jesus. They had no idea. Mm-hmm. Who Jesus was. B, the parent suddenly realized, like, oh, wow, this is something that I'd be open to them learning, and they'd be open to learning. You know, and C, like, there's a beautiful invitation there, and that's okay. So a lot of the baggage going away is a healthy thing, and it gives us an opportunity with a fresh perspective, with a fresh conversation, to invite people in to a place of healing, to a place of beauty, to a place of meaning and purpose, and a place of truth. Those are all really good things that people are seeking in this generation. And the church has got some great answers if we can approach it in that way.
Yeah, I think that's such a beautiful picture. And it just, it kind of reminds me, as you're talking, I'm just thinking of what happens during a forest fire or a brush fire. You know, it really cleans and then nourishes the ground so that new beginnings come, and they're even stronger and more vibrant than the ones before. And I think that gives me hope.
I know it does. And we fight the fire. Our tendency is to fight the fire, but there's something good happening right now.
Yeah, no, I think that is so hopeful. So I want to turn our attention just quickly to evangelism, because you guys did an incredible project with Alpha, which showed that almost half of millennials, 47%, agree at least somewhat that it is wrong to share one's personal beliefs with someone else of a different faith in hopes that they will one day share the same faith. So that's kind of a massively loaded sentence, but can you shed some light on just kind of what this research was about, and just kind of where people are at in this millennial generation with sharing their faith?
Yeah, that's great. So we were trying to test about evangelism without using that word, because it's such a loaded word.
Yeah, that's true. What did you use?
That we had to use that phrase. So yeah. When we will report that, you know, half of millennials think it's wrong to evangelize, that is the phrase that we used. And so that phrase doesn't come with all sorts of cultural baggage. It comes mm-hmm. with purely, I'm having a conversation, and I'm going to tell this person about my own beliefs. And in my heart, I really hope that one day they'll share the beauty of that belief, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not even a confrontational statement. And yet half of them are like, no, that's wrong.
47% said, I'm not doing that.
Right, exactly. At the same time, more than 9 out of 10, like 94%, I believe it is, say the best thing that can happen to someone is for them to come into a relationship with Jesus. So these same people who are concerned about sharing their faith believe that their faith has life-giving properties to it, that it's such a good thing, a healthy thing. And they're right. There's lots of evidence of the life-giving nature of faith in Christianity specifically. So one of the things that we are very confident is at play here is just this, what I'll call political correctness, but it's actually not even political, suggests the wrong thing. It's just the social acceptedness of, if I tell someone something that I believe is true, it suggests that they might be wrong, and that's not good. And I don't want to suggest that they might be wrong. So what in their heart of hearts they're doing is being empathetic and kind towards others, which is a great thing. But also at the same time, they're being afraid to speak the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to own that. Now, we've had some people come to us reading these stats and immediately get judgmental of the generation. So mm-hmm. we don't want to do that, because their empathy is very important and good. But we do need to be clear about what truth is. And if we don't stand up for truth as a church, we don't stand for any sort of belief. Like, why are we here, right? So we have to believe at least that there's foundational truth, that our beliefs are true. So that's important, I think, for their continued discipleship. But also knowing that what we see and hear more than ever from millennials is that they desire to live out their faith through their actions. So they will gently insert opinions in cultural context about situations that have to do with things like kindness, about joy, about justice, about love. All these things suggest that they're building upon their biblical beliefs, but they are concerned, and sometimes rightly so, that that's going to trigger someone to be like, oh, you're trying to push your agenda on me. Mm-hmm. I'm not standing for it. So they gently work those things in by their actions and their words in certain contexts. Now, I think we all can be a little more forthright about why we have our beliefs and why we have our values. But their intuition about the culture is right and important. So part of that study is we also interviewed, those were the practicing Christians, we also interviewed people who were not practicing Christians. So they either may have said, I'm a Christian, but I never go to church, or more commonly they said, I'm not a Christian, I wouldn't call myself that. Those people, when they said they had had a conversation with someone about things of a spiritual nature, really thought that conversation went well and were open to having further conversation when the person listened without judgment, when they asked questions, and when they showed that they valued them as a person. Mm-hmm. Now, you can communicate the gospel in that way. You can also communicate the gospel in a way that is judgmental, in a way that suggests you're right and they're wrong, and they have no value as a result. So what we hear from both sides, that we're not just trying to make people happy in sharing the gospel, that's not the point. But the point is, if we want to continue to have that conversation and they're going to continue to be open to it, then we have to recognize that if we come across as judgmental or we come across as unwilling to listen, then they're also going to be unwilling to listen.
So what do you suggest for people who are working in this space, myself included, in evangelism? And, you know, there are a gajillion tools and methodologies and ways to help encourage people to share their faith. What would you say to those groups of people about these generations and the research specifically to evangelism and how to kind of go about this in a new generation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So first of all, I will say personal style and gifting matters. So there are a million ways to do it. And it's really important to be authentic. That is number one. Because if someone, especially with this generation, if someone questions your authenticity, they're going to dismiss you immediately.
Yeah, it's so important to them. The authenticity of a person and a conversation, they can sniff it out so fast.
So you got to start with that. You can't force fit something that someone else says is a good method that doesn't feel natural and normal to you. It doesn't fit your personality, right? So God's gifted you with a certain personality, a certain style, a certain, well, many gifts. And so use those. That's step one. But two is knowing that maybe the last 30 years or so, maybe it's been a little longer, many ministries have focused on helping people to see truth. But to a generation that believes that truth is relative and doesn't actually value truth and thinks that it's hard to see truth because there's so much fake news, that's a really rocky starting place.
Yeah, that's you're already behind.
Yeah, so they've already put the strikes against you, right?
Yeah.
So not to say that they're not interested in truth. It's just a tough starting place because there's so many reasons why that's not going to resonate. So what they're interested in is Christianity good? And is it relevant to me? And the relevant to me is really the starting place. So if we're coming with a sense of empathy, if we're coming with a sense of really valuing that other person and wanting what's good for them, which we believe is Jesus, right? If we really want what's good for them, then we first need to get to know them. So in getting to know them, not only do we learn just who they are, which is beautiful because we see God in them, but we also learn what they're wrestling with. And that's where we start. We start with where they are, right? So people today are not starting with the question of what happens to me when I die. They don't care about that. They care about what happens to me tomorrow when I'm struggling with anxiety and I can't do what I need to do. Mm-hmm. What happens to me in a year or 2 years when I'm still not married and I'm lonely?
So I feel like we could unpack that for like another hour and a half. So I think it is so helpful. We'll kind of take another left turn here, but I just want to say, I think that is so, so helpful. And I just have to say, Brooke, and to David too, thank you guys so much for doing this work. Like it, I feel like I've just read 4 chapters of a book with all of the information that's coming out. Like I'm like, it's a book I can't put down. And so I am just, I have to just pause and say, thank you for doing this work. I think it is so, so critical. I want to talk.
It's truly our blessing to be able to do it.
Well, you guys are doing just a fantastic job. I want to just take a quick turn towards cities. A lot of people listening to this podcast are doing incredible gospel work in their cities. And I know that you guys have some really great tools for people to utilize. Can you just kind of talk about that a little bit for how people would access those for their individual cities?
Thank you for asking. So we've had a really neat year of being able to dive into a lot of our historic data and make it more accessible. And that's been our focus over the last, I say, year and a half, because we have so many great digital tools available in general as society right now. So we're trying to use those. So we have historically collected data about people's beliefs and people's practices. And what's unique about the work that we do is many people will track demographics, and they'll track, like, if they're engaged in a church, and they'll track even if they read the Bible, but people don't often ask questions about what people believe. And we think that's really critical if you're in the church space. So we've got these questions that we've gathered up over the years. And what we do is we pull those questions that are consistent, we pull them together, and we group them by city, the city that the person who responded to the survey came from. And what that enables us to do is say, hey, over the last year, we've talked to 200 people to 500 people in this city, and we can tell you a little bit about what they believe, not just who they are, but actually the starting point of what they believe. So that's something that we had published for years in books called Cities and States. And this year we were able to put that online in a database called FaithView. And you can find FaithView on our website. We haven't done a ton of publicity around it, but it's definitely available. The reason we created it is because people naturally had questions. They looked at our cities and states reports and they said, well, that's great, but well, tell me about just the millennials in my city. So this tool allows you to do that. You kind of get the first glance of who's in my city, and then you go, well, now I want to do this. And so you can do that. You can look at different groups of people. You can look at single parents. That would be interesting. You know, you can look at just people who say that they have a faith in Jesus, and how has that changed over time? So It's a great tool for being able to understand the context in which you operate. Now, this is the critical thing. People go, that's great, but my neighborhood is unique. And you're right. You need to know your neighborhood, because it is true that every neighborhood has a different look and feel. We don't have that level of granularity. However, what we have seen is that different cities have different worldviews functioning within them. And there's actually a bit of a continuum, I would say, in our country. You know, we refer to the South as the Bible Belt for a reason. We refer to kind of the Pacific Northwest and the New England area as post-Christian, also for a reason. They're more secular in nature. And if you look across the country, all of the cities or markets across our country kind of fit into a continuum between those. And it's really important to know your context, because you might be in Chattanooga and think, gosh, this world is becoming increasingly secular. But Chattanooga is the most evangelically oriented city in the country. So you need to know that. You need to know that more people are starting from a place of appreciating the church than they are of starting from secularism, right? So it just helps you understand the context in which you're operating. And going back to the beginning of, we talked about what shapes your worldview. Well, your city also shapes your worldview. So it's almost like being in a cup of tea. That tea bag is in there and you're soaking it in. You may not realize you're in a cup of tea. You thought you were in a cup of water, but you soak it all in, right? You soak in the beliefs of the people around you and the culture around you. So it's really important to understand your city and then to dig deeper, to really get to know what's happening in your city and how God's calling you to be a part of that and to engage with your city and not just kind of pursue your agenda, right? Because every city's got some nuances into where they are and what they need.
Well, I recommend checking out the Barna site and checking out your city view, because the more we have the information, just everything can change. And our ability to look, whether it's at our city or at the people in our church or our own kids and their friends, it's at least for me in this hour, Brooke, it's really been such an impactful time. And I just cannot thank you enough. I'm so grateful for your story and how the Lord brought you through all those early job opportunities to bring you here for such a time as this and the organization. So just thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's been a great pleasure to talk through these things, and I hope everyone's feeling, you know, that their blood pressure has dropped a little bit after that conversation. But yeah, it's a delight to be able to see. I mean, I count it a blessing that we get to see at a 30,000 foot view what the church is doing. And let me just say that the view from up here is actually really encouraging. I love to see how God is moving in our world, and we get the pleasure of seeing it, and it's good. So encouragements to everyone who's listening, who is in ministry and on the ground. You're doing great work. So just keep listening and learning and going for it.
Amen, sister. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gosh, that conversation was so inspiring. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. To stay in touch with the latest content, just remember to subscribe. It's super easy. And also, keep the conversation going by DMing us on Instagram at City Gospel Movements.
Thank you for listening to the City Gospel Movements podcast, where we celebrate and accelerate collaborative gospel work in cities around the world. For more resources, show notes, and to get connected to gospel movements around the globe, visit citygospelmovements.org. That's citygospelmovements.org. Keep believing in what God can do in your city.